A shoemaker was busy at work on one side of the arch, while the woman opposite kept track of several children, customers, and a large account book. She gave Matthew a brisk nod. Robert Hawley's wife rules over his apprentices and customers with an iron fist. "Nothing happens in the Heart and Crown without Margaret's knowledge," explained Matthew. "I made a mental note to befriend the woman at the earliest opportunity." The passage emptied out into the building's interior courtyard, a luxury in a city as densely packed as London. The courtyard boasted another rare amenity, a well that provided clean water to the residents of the complex. Someone had taken advantage of the courtyard's southern exposure by tearing up the old paving stones to plant a garden, and now its neat, empty beds patiently awaited spring. A group of washerwomen conducted business out of an old shed next to a shared privy. To the left, a twisting set of stairs rose to our rooms on the first floor, where Françoise was waiting to welcome us on the wide landing. She'd flung open the stout door into the apartments, crowding a cupboard with pierced sides. A goose, denuded of feathers and with its neck broken, was tied to one of the cupboard's knobs.
"At last," Henry Percy appeared, beaming. "We've been waiting for hours. My good lady mother sent you a goose. She heard reports that no fowl are to be had in the city, and became alarmed that you would go hungry."
"It is good to see you, Hal," Matthew said with a laugh and a shake of his head at the goose. "How is your mother?"
"Always a termagant at Christmas, thank you. Most of the family found excuses to be elsewhere, but I am detained here at the Queen's pleasure. Her Majesty shouted across the audience chamber that I could not be trusted even so far as Petworth.
Henry stammered and looked ill at the recollection.
"You are more than welcome to spend Christmas with us, Henry," I said, taking off my cloak and stepping inside, where the scent of spices and freshly cut fur filled the air.
"It is good of you to invite me, Diana, but my sister Eleanor and brother George are in town, and they shouldn't have to brave her on their own."
"Stay with us this evening, at least," Matthew urged, steering him to the right, where warmth and firelight beckoned, "and tell us what has happened while we were away."
"All is quiet here,"
Henry reported cheerfully.
"Quiet?"
Galloglass stomped up the stairs, looking frostily at the Earl.
"Marlowe's at the Cardinal's Hat, drunk as a fiddler, trading verses with that impoverished scrivener from Stratford who trails after him in hopes of becoming a playwright. For now, Shakespeare seems content with learning how to forge your signature, Matthew. According to the innkeeper's records, you promised to pay Kit's room and board charges last week." "I left them only an hour ago," Henry protested. "Kit knew that Matthew and Diana were due to arrive this afternoon. He and Will promised to be on their best behavior."
"That explains it, then," Galloglass muttered sarcastically.
"Is this your doing, Henry?" I looked from the entrance hall into our main living quarters. Someone had tucked holly, ivy, and fir around the fireplace and the window frames and mounded them in the center of an oak table. The fireplace was loaded with logs, and a cheerful fire hissed and crackled.
"Françoise and I wanted your first Christmas to be festive," Henry said, turning pink.
The Heart and Crown represented urban living at its 16th century best. The parlor was a good size, but felt snug and comfortable. Its western wall was filled with a multi-paned window that overlooked Water Lane. It was perfectly situated for people watching, with a cushioned seat built into the base. Carved wainscoting warmed the walls, each panel covered with twisting flowers and vines. The room's furnishings were spare but well-made. A wide settle and two deep chairs waited by the fireplace. The oak table in the center of the room was unusually fine, less than 3 feet across but quite long, its legs decorated with the delicate faces of caryatids and herms. A beam set with candles hung over the table. It could be raised and lowered by use of the smooth rope and pulley system suspended from the ceiling. Carved lion's heads snarled from the front band of a monstrous cupboard that held a wide array of beakers, pitchers, cups, and goblets, though very few plates, as befitted a vampire household. Before we settled down to our dinner of roast goose, Matthew showed me our bedroom and his private office.
Both were across the entrance hall opposite the parlor. Gabled windows overlooked the courtyard, making both rooms feel light and surprisingly airy. The bedroom had only three pieces of furniture, a four-poster bed with a carved headboard and heavy wooden tester, a tall linen press with paneled sides and door, and a long low chest under the windows. The last was locked, and Matthew explained that it held his suit of armor and several spare weapons. Henry and Francoise had been in here, too. Ivy crawled up the bedposts, and they'd tied sprigs of holly to the headboard. Whereas the bedroom looked barely occupied, Matthew's office was clearly well used. Here there were baskets of paper, bags and tankards full of quills, pots of ink, enough wax to make several dozen candles, balls of twine, and so much waiting mail that my heart sank just thinking about it. A comfortable-looking chair with a sloping back and curved arm sat before a table with extendable leaves. Except for the heavy table legs with their bulbous, cup-shaped carvings, everything was plain and practical. Though I had blanched at the piles of work that awaited him, Matthew was unconcerned.
"It can all wait. Not even spies conduct business on Christmas Eve," he told me.
Over dinner, we talked more about Walter's latest exploits and the shocking state of traffic in London, and we steered clear of more sober subjects, like Kit's latest drinking binge and the enterprising William Shakespeare. After the plates were cleared, Matthew pulled a small game table away from the wall. He removed a deck of cards from the compartment under the tabletop and proceeded to teach me how to gamble, Elizabethan style. Henry had just persuaded Matthew and Galloglass to play Flapdragon, an alarming game that involved setting raisins alight in a dish of brandy and betting on who could swallow the greatest number, when the sound of carolers rose from the street outside the windows. They were not all singing in the same key, and those who didn't know the words were inserting scandalous details about the personal lives of Joseph and Mary.
"Here, milord," Pierre said, thrusting a bag of coins at Matthew.
"Do we have cakes?" Matthew asked Francoise.
She looked at him as if he'd lost his mind.
"Of course we have cakes. They're in the new food cupboard on the landing, where the smell will not disturb anyone," Francoise said, pointing in the direction of the stairs. "Last year you gave them wine, but I do not believe they require it tonight."
"I'll go with you, Matt," Henry volunteered. "I like a good song on Christmas Eve."
The appearance of Matthew and Henry downstairs was marked by a definite uptick in the choir's volume. When the carolers came to a rather uneven finish, Matthew thanked them and passed out coins. Henry distributed the cakes, which led to many bows and a hushed,
"Thank you, my lord,"
as the news passed that this was the Earl of Northumberland. The carolers moved off to another house, following some mysterious order of precedence that they hoped would ensure them the best refreshments and payments. Soon I could no longer smother my yawns, and Henry and Galloglass began to gather up their gloves and cloaks. Both were smiling like satisfied matchmakers when they headed for the door. Matthew joined me in bed, holding me until I fell asleep, humming carols and naming the city's many bells as they sounded the hour.
"There is St. Mary Le Bow," he said, listening to the sounds of the city. "And St. Catherine Cree."
"Is that St. Paul's?" I asked as a prolonged clarion sounded.
"No. The lightning that took off the steeple destroyed the bells, too," he said. "That's St. Saviour's. We passed it on our way into town."
The rest of London's churches caught up with Southwark's Cathedral. Finally, a straggler finished with a discordant clang, the last sound I heard before sleep overtook me. In the middle of the night, I was awakened by conversation coming from Matthew's study. I felt the bed, but he was no longer with me. The leather straps that held up the mattress squeaked and stretched as I jumped to the cold floor. I shivered and threw on a shawl before leaving the room. Judging by the pools of wax in the shallow candle stands, Matthew had been working for hours. Pierre was with him, standing next to the shelves built into a recess by the fireplace. He looked as though he'd been dragged backward through the Thames mud at low tide.
"I've been all over the city with Galloglass and his Irish friends,"
Pierre murmured. If the Scots know anything more about the schoolmaster, they will not divulge it, my lord.
What schoolmaster? I stepped into the room. It was then I spotted the narrow door hidden in the wooden paneling.
I am sorry, madame. I did not mean to wake you.
Pierre's dismay showed through the filth, and the stench that accompanied him made my eyes water.
It's all right, Pierre, go. I'll find you later.
Matthew waited while his servant fled, shoes squelching. Matthew's eyes drifted to the shadows by the fireplace. The room that lies beyond that door wasn't on your welcome tour, I pointed out, going to his side. What's happened now?
More news from Scotland. A jury sentenced a wizard named John Fian, a schoolmaster from Preston Pans, to death. While I was away, Galloglass tried to find out what truth, if any, lies behind the wild accusations. Worshipping Satan, dismembering dead bodies in a graveyard, transforming moles' feet into pieces of silver so he was never without money, going to sea in a ship with the devil and Agnes Sampson to thwart the king's policies. Matthew tossed a paper onto the table in front of him. So far as I can tell, Fian is one of what we used to call the Tempestarii, and nothing more.
A wind witch, or possibly a water witch, I said, translating the unfamiliar term.
Yes, Matthew agreed with a nod.
Fian augmented his teacher's salary by causing thunderstorms during dry spells and early thaws when it looked as if the Scottish winter would never end. His fellow villagers adored him, by all accounts. Even Fian's pupils had nothing but praise. Fian might have been a bit of a seer. He's credited with foretelling people's deaths, but that could have been something Kit cooked up to embellish the story for an English audience. He's obsessed with a witch's second sight, as you'll remember.
Witches are vulnerable to the shifting moods of our neighbors, Matthew. One minute we're friends, the next we're run out of town, or worse.
What happened to Fian was definitely worse, Matthew said grimly.
I can imagine, I said with a shudder. If Fian had been tortured as Agnes Sampson had, he must have welcomed death.
What's in that room?
Matthew considered telling me that it was a secret, but wisely refrained. He stood.
It would be better if I showed you. Stay by me. It's not yet dawn, and we can't take a candle into the room for fear that someone will see it from outside. I don't want you to trip.
I nodded mutely and took his hand. We stepped across the threshold into a long room with a row of windows barely larger than arrow slits tucked under the eaves. After a few moments, my eyes adjusted and gray shapes began to emerge from the gloom. A pair of old garden chairs woven from willow twigs stood across from each other, their backs curved forward. Low, battered benches were set out in two rows down the center of the room. Each bore a strange assortment of objects, books, papers, letters, hats, and clothes. From the right came a gleam of metal, swords, hilts up and points down. A pile of daggers rested on the floor nearby. There was a scratching sound, too, and a scurry of feet.
Rats.
Matthew's voice was matter of fact, but I couldn't help drawing my night rail tight against my legs. Pierre and I do what we can, but it's impossible to get rid of them entirely. I find all this paper irresistible. He gestured up, and I noticed for the first time the bizarre festoons on the walls. I crept closer and peered at the garlands. Each one hung from a thin, twisted cord affixed to the plaster with a square-headed nail. The cord had been threaded through the upper left-hand corner of a series of documents. The knot in the end of the cord was slung back up and looped around the same nail, creating a wreath of paper.
One of the world's first file cabinets. You say I keep too many secrets, he said softly, reaching out and snagging one of the garlands. You can add these to your reckoning.
But there are thousands of them. Surely not even a 1,500-year-old vampire could possess so many.
There are, Matthew agreed.
He watched as my eyes swept the room, taking in the archive he guarded.
We remember what other creatures want to forget, and that makes it possible for the Knights of Lazarus to protect those in our care. Some of the secrets go back to the reign of the Queen's grandfather. Most of the older files have already been moved to Set-Tor for safekeeping.
So many trails of paper, I murmured, and all of them ultimately lead back to you and the de Clermonts. The room faded until I saw only the loops and swirls of the words unwinding into long, intertwined filaments. They formed a map of connections that linked subjects, authors, dates. There was something I needed to understand about these crisscrossing lines.
I've been going through these papers since you fell asleep, looking for references to Fionn. I thought that there might be mention of him here, Matthew said, leading me back into his study. Something that might explain why his neighbors turned on him. There must be a pattern that will tell us why the humans are behaving this way.
If you find it, my fellow historians will be eager to know. But understanding Fionn's case doesn't guarantee you can prevent the same thing from happening to me.
The ticking muscle in Matthew's jaw told me that my words found their target. And I'm quite sure you didn't delve into the matter this closely before. I'm no longer that man who turned a blind eye to all this suffering, and I don't want to become him again. Matthew pulled out his chair and dropped heavily into it. There must be something I can do. I gathered him in my arms. Even seated, Matthew was so tall that the top of his head hit my rib cage. He burrowed into me. He stilled, then drew slowly away, his eyes fixed on my abdomen.
Diana, you're...
He stopped.
Pregnant.
I thought so, I said matter-of-factly. My period's been irregular ever since Juliet, so I wasn't sure. I was sick on the way from Calais to Dover, but the seas were rough, and that fish I had before we left was definitely dodgy. He continued to stare at my belly. I rattled on nervously. My high school health teacher was right. You really can get pregnant the first time you have sex with a guy. I'd done the math and was pretty sure conception had occurred during our wedding weekend. Still, he was silent.
Say something, Matthew.
It's impossible. He looked stunned. Everything about us is impossible. I lowered a trembling hand to my stomach. Matthew twined his fingers through mine and finally looked me in the eye. I was surprised by what I saw there. Awe, pride, and a hint of panic. Then he smiled. It was an expression of complete joy. What if I'm no good at being a parent? I asked uncertainly. You've been a father, you know what to do.
You're going to be a wonderful mother, was his prompt response. All that children need is love, a grown-up to take responsibility for them, and a soft place to land.
Matthew moved our clasped hands over my belly in a gentle caress. We'll tackle the first two together. The last will be up to you. How are you feeling?
A bit tired and queasy, physically. Emotionally, I don't know where to begin. I drew a shaky breath. Is it normal to be frightened and fierce and tender all at once?
Yes. And thrilled and anxious and sick with dread, too, he said softly.
I know it's ridiculous, but I keep worrying that my magic might hurt the baby, even though thousands of witches give birth every year.
But they aren't married to vampires. This isn't a normal conception, Matthew said, reading my mind. Still, I don't think you need to concern yourself.
A shadow moved through his eyes. I could practically see him adding one more worry to his list. I don't want to tell anyone. Not yet. I thought of the room next door. Can your life include one more secret? At least for a little while?
Of course, Matthew said promptly. Your pregnancy won't show for months. But Francoise and Pierre will know soon from your scent, if they don't already, and so will Hancock and Galloglass. Happily, vampires don't usually ask personal questions.
I laughed softly. It figures that I'll be the one to give the secret away. You can't possibly be any more protective, so no one is going to guess what we're hiding based on your behavior.
Don't be too sure of that, he said, smiling broadly.
Matthew flexed his fingers over mine. It was a distinctly protective gesture. If you keep touching me that way, people are going to figure it out pretty quickly, I agreed dryly, running my fingers along his shoulder. He shivered.
You're not supposed to shiver when you feel something warm.
That's not why I'm trembling. Matthew stood, blocking out the light from the candles. My heart caught at the sight of him. He smiled, hearing the slight irregularity, and drew me toward the bed. We shed our clothes, tossing them to the floor, where they lay in two white pools that caught the silvery light from the windows. Matthew's touches were feather light while he tracked the minute changes already taking place in my body. He lingered over each centimeter of tender flesh. But his cool attention increased the ache rather than soothing it. Every kiss was as knotted and complex as our feelings about sharing a child. At the same time, the words he whispered in the darkness encouraged me to focus solely on him. When I could bear waiting no longer, Matthew seated himself within me, his movements unhurried and gentle, like his kiss. I arched my back in an effort to increase the contact between us, and Matthew stilled. With my spine bowed, he was poised at the entrance to my womb. And in that brief, forever moment, father, mother, and child were as close as any three creatures could be.
My whole heart, my whole life, he promised, moving within me.
I cried out, and Matthew held me close until the trembling stopped. He then kissed his way down the length of my body, starting with my witch's third eye and continuing on to my lips, throat, breastbone, solar plexus, navel, and at last my abdomen. He stared down at me, shook his head, and gave me a boyish grin.
We made a child, he said, dumbfounded.
We did, I agreed with an answering smile. Matthew slid his shoulders between my thighs, pushing them wide. With one arm wrapped around my knee and the other twined around the opposite hip so that his hand could rest on the pulse there, he lowered his head onto my belly as though it were a pillow and let out a contented sigh. Utterly quiet, he listened for the soft whooshing of the blood that now sustained our child. When he heard it, he tilted his head so our eyes met. He smiled, bright and true, and returned to his vigil. In the candlelit darkness of Christmas morning, I felt the quiet power that came from sharing our love with another creature. No longer a solitary meteor moving through space and time, I was now part of a complicated planetary system. I needed to learn how to keep my own center of gravity while being pulled this way and that by bodies larger and more powerful than I was. Otherwise, Matthew, the de Clermonts, our child, and the congregation might pull me off course. My time with my mother had been too short, but in 7 years she had taught me plenty. I remembered her unconditional love, the hugs that seemed to encompass days, and how she was always right where I needed her to be. It was as Matthew said, children needed love, a reliable source of comfort, and an adult willing to take responsibility for them. It was time to stop treating our sojourn here as an advanced seminar in Shakespeare's England and recognize it instead as my last, best chance to figure out who I was so that I could help my child understand his place in the world. But first, I needed to find a witch.
Chapter 16. We passed the weekend quietly, reveling in our secret and indulging in the speculations of all parents-to-be. Would the newest member of the de Clermont clan have black hair like his father, but my blue eyes? Would he like science or history?
Would he be skilled with his hands like Matthew, or all thumbs like me? As for the sex, we had different opinions. I was convinced it was a boy, and Matthew was equally sure it was a girl. Exhausted and exhilarated, we took a break from thoughts of the future to view 16th-century London from the warmth of our rooms. We started at the windows overlooking Water Lane, where I spied the distant towers of Westminster Abbey, and finished in the chairs pulled up to the bedroom windows where we could see the Thames. Neither the cold nor the fact that it was the Christian day of rest kept the watermen from their business making deliveries and ferrying passengers. At the bottom of our street, a group of rowers for hire huddled on the stairs that led down to the waterside, their empty boats bobbing up and down on the swells. Matthew shared his memories of the city during the course of the afternoon as the tide rose and fell. He told me about the time in the 15th century when the Thames froze for more than 3 months, so long that temporary shops were built on the ice to cater to the foot traffic. He also reminisced about his unproductive years at Thavies Inn, where he had gone through the motions of studying the law for the fourth and final time. "I'm glad you got to see it before we leave," he said, squeezing my hand. One by one, people were illuminating their lamps, hanging them from the prows of boats and setting them in the windows of houses and inns. "We'll even try to fit in a visit to the Royal Exchange." "We're going back to Woodstock?" I asked, confused.
"For a short time, perhaps. Then we'll be going back to our present."
I stared at him, too startled to speak.
"We don't know what to expect during the gestation period, and for your safety and the child's, we need to monitor the baby. There are tests to run, and it would be a good idea to have a baseline ultrasound. Besides, you'll want to be with Sarah and Emily."
"But Matthew," I protested, "we can't go home yet. I don't know how."
His head swung around.
"Em explained it clearly before we left. To travel back in time, you need three objects to take you where you want to go. To travel forward, you need witchcraft, but I can't do spells. It's why we came."
"You can't possibly carry the baby to term here," Matthew said, shooting out of his chair.
"Women do have babies in the 16th century," I said mildly. "Besides, I don't feel any different. I can't be more than a few weeks pregnant."
"Will you be powerful enough to carry both her and me back to the future?"
"No. We need to leave as soon as possible and well before she's born."
Matthew drew to a halt.
"What if time-walking damages the fetus in some way? Magic is one thing, but this..."
He sat down abruptly. "Nothing has changed," I said soothingly. "The baby can't be much bigger than a grain of rice. Now that we're in London, it shouldn't be difficult to find someone to help me with my magic. Not to mention one who understands time-walking better than Sarah and Em."
"She's the size of a lentil."
Matthew stopped. He thought for a few moments and came to a decision.
"By 6 weeks, all the most critical fetal developments will have taken place. That should give you plenty of time."
He sounded like a doctor, not a father. I was beginning to prefer Matthew's pre-modern rages to his modern objectivity.
"That gives me only a few weeks. What if I need 7?
Had Sarah been in the room, she would have warned him that my reasonableness was not a good sign.
7 weeks would be fine," Matthew said, lost in his own thoughts.
"Oh, well, that's good. I'd hate to feel rushed when it comes to something as important as figuring out who I am."
I strode toward him.
"Diana, that's not..." We were standing nose to nose now. "I don't have a chance of being a good mother without knowing more about the power in my blood."
"This isn't good..."
"Don't you dare say this isn't good for the baby. I'm not some vessel."
My temper was at full boil now.
"First it was my blood you wanted for your scientific experiments, and now it's this baby."
Matthew, damn him, stood quietly by, arms crossed and gray eyes hard.
"Well?" I demanded.
"Well, what? Apparently my participation in this conversation isn't required. You're already finishing my sentences. You might as well start them, too."
"This has nothing to do with my hormones," I said. Belatedly, it occurred to me that this statement alone was probably evidence to the contrary.
That hadn't occurred to me until you mentioned it.
That's not what it sounded like.
His eyebrow rose.
I'm the same person I was 3 days ago. Pregnancy isn't a pathological condition, and it doesn't eliminate our reason for being here. We haven't even had a proper chance to look for Ashmole 782. Ashmole 782?
Matthew made an impatient sound.
Everything has changed, and you are not the same person. We can't keep this pregnancy a secret indefinitely. In a matter of days, every vampire will be able to smell the changes in your body. Kit will figure it out soon after, and he'll be asking about the father, because it can't be me, can it?
A pregnant witch living with a werch will raise the animosity of every creature in this city, even the ones who don't care much for the Covenant. Someone could complain to the congregation. My father will demand we go back to Set Tor for your safety, and I can't endure saying goodbye to him one more time.
His voice rose steadily with each problem.
I didn't think...
No, Matthew interrupted, you didn't. You couldn't have. Christ, Diana. Before, you and I were in a forbidden marriage. That's hardly unique. Now you're carrying my child. That's not only unique. Other creatures believe it's impossible. 3 more weeks, Diana, not a moment more.
He was implacable.
You might not be able to find a witch willing to help me by then, I persisted, not with what's happening in Scotland.
Who said anything about willingness?
Matthew's smile chilled me.
I'm going to the parlor to read.
I turned toward the bedroom, wanting to be as far from him as possible. He was waiting for me in the doorway, his arm barring my passage.
I will not lose you, Diana, he said, emphatic but quiet. Not to look for an alchemical manuscript, and not for the sake of an unborn child.
And I will not lose myself, I retorted. Not to satisfy your need for control. Not before I find out who I am. On Monday, I was again sitting in the parlor, picking through The Fairy Queen and going out of my mind with boredom when the door opened. Visitors. I clapped the book shut eagerly.
I don't think I'll ever be warm again.
Walter stood dripping in the doorway. George and Henry were with him, both looking equally wretched.
Hello, Diana.
Henry sneezed, then greeted me with a formal bow before heading to the fireplace and extending his fingers toward the flames with a groan. Where is Matthew? I asked, motioning George toward a seat.
With Kit. We left them at a bookseller.
Walter gestured in the direction of St. Paul's.
I'm famished. The stew Kit ordered for dinner was inedible.
Matt said Francois should make us something to eat.
Raleigh's mischievous grin betrayed his lie. The lads were on their second plates of food and their third helping of wine when Matthew came home with Kit, an armful of books, and a full complement of facial hair, courtesy of one of these wizard barbers I kept hearing about. My husband's trim new mustache suited the width of his mouth, and his beard was fashionably small and well-shaped. Pierre followed behind, bearing a linen sack of paper rectangles and squares.
Thank God, Walter said, nodding approvingly at the beard. Now you look like yourself.
Hello, my heart, Matthew said, kissing me on the cheek.
Do you recognize me?
Yes, even though you look like a pirate, I said with a laugh.
It is true, Diana. He and Walter look like brothers now, admitted Henry.
Why do you persist in calling Matthew's wife by her first name, Henry? Has Mistress Royden become your ward? Is she your sister now? The only other explanation is that you're planning a seduction, Marlowe grumbled, plunking himself down in a chair.
Stop poking at the hornet's nest, Kit, Walter chided.
I have belated Christmas presents, Matthew said, sliding his stack in my direction.
Books? It was disconcerting to feel their obvious newness. The creak of the tight bindings as they protested being opened for the first time, the smell of paper and the tang of ink. I was used to seeing volumes like these in a worn condition within library reading rooms, not resting on the table where we ate our meals. The top volume was a blank book to replace the one still in Oxford. The next was a book of prayers, beautifully bound. The ornate title page was adorned with a reclining figure of the biblical patriarch Jesse. A sprawling tree emerged from his stomach. My forehead creased. Why had Matthew bought me a prayer book?
"Turn the page," he urged, his hands heavy and quiet against the small of my back. On the reverse was a woodcut of Queen Elizabeth kneeling in prayer. Skeletons, biblical figures, and classical virtues decorated each page. The book was a combination of text and imagery, just like the alchemical treatises I studied.
"It's exactly the kind of book a respectable married lady would own," Matthew said with a grin. He lowered his voice conspiratorially. "That should satisfy your desire to keep up appearances. But don't worry, the next one isn't respectable at all."
I put the prayer book aside and took the thick volume Matthew offered. Its pages were sewn together and slipped inside a protective wrapper of thick vellum. The treatise promised to explain the symptoms and cures of every disease known to afflict mankind.
"Religious books are popular gifts and easy to sell. Books about medicine have a smaller audience and are too costly to bind without a commission," Matthew explained as I fingered the limp covering. He handed me yet another volume. Luckily, I had already ordered a bound copy of this one. It's hot off the presses and destined to be a bestseller.
The item in question was covered in simple black leather, with some silver stamps for ornamentation. Inside was a first edition of Philip Sidney's Arcadia. I laughed, remembering how much I'd hated reading it in college.
"A witch cannot live by prayer and physic alone."
Matthew's eyes twinkled with mischief. His mustache tickled when he moved to kiss me.
"Your new face is going to take some getting used to," I said, laughing and rubbing my lips at the unexpected sensation.
The Earl of Northumberland eyed me as he would a piece of horseflesh in need of a training regimen.
"These few titles will not keep Diana occupied for long. She's used to more varied activity."
"As you say. But she can hardly roam the city and offer classes on alchemy."
Matthew's mouth tightened with amusement. Hour by hour, his accent and choice of words molded to the time. He leaned over me, sniffed the wine jug, and grimaced.
"Is there something to drink that hasn't been doused with cloves and pepper? It smells dreadful."
"Diana might enjoy Mary's company," Henry suggested,
not having heard Matthew's query. Matthew stared at Henry.
"Mary?" "They are of a similar age and temperament, I think, and both are paragons of learning."
"The Countess is not only learned, but also has a propensity for setting things alight," Kit observed,
pouring himself another generous beaker of wine. He stuck his nose in it and breathed deeply. It smelled rather like Matthew.
"Stay away from her stills and furnaces, Mistress Royden, unless you want fashionably frizzled hair."
"Furnaces?" I wondered who this could be.
"Ah, yes, the Countess of Pembroke," George said, eyes gleaming at the prospect of patronage.
"Absolutely not."
Between Raleigh, Chapman, and Marlowe, I'd met enough literary legends to last me a lifetime. The Countess was the foremost woman of letters in the country, and Sir Philip Sidney's sister.
"I'm not ready for Mary Sidney."
"Nor is Mary Sidney ready for you, Mistress Royden, but I suspect that Henry is right. You will soon grow tired of Matthew's friends and need to seek your own. Without them, you will be prone to idleness and melancholy."
Walter nodded to Matthew.
"You should invite Mary here to share supper."
"The Blackfriars would come to a complete standstill if the Countess of Pembroke appeared on Water Lane. It would be far better to send Mistress Royden to Baynard's Castle. It's just over the wall," Marlowe said, eager to be rid of me.
"Diana would have to walk into the city," Matthew said pointedly.
Marlowe gave a dismissive snort.
"It's the week between Christmas and New Year.
Nobody will pay attention if two married women share a cup of wine and some gossip.
I'd be happy to take her, Walter volunteered.
Perhaps Mary will want to know more about my venture in the New World.
You will have to ask the Countess to invest in Virginia another time. If Diana goes, I'll be with her.
Matthew's eyes sharpened. I wonder if Mary knows any witches.
She's a woman, isn't she? Of course she knows witches, Marlowe said.
Shall I write to her then, Matt?
Henry inquired.
Thank you, Hal.
Matthew was clearly unconvinced of the merits of the plan. Then he sighed. It's been too long since I've seen her. Tell Mary we'll call on her tomorrow. My initial reluctance to meet Mary Sidney faded as our rendezvous approached. The more I remembered and discovered about the Countess of Pembroke, the more excited I became. Françoise was in a state of high anxiety about the visit, and she fussed over my clothes for hours. She fixed a particularly frothy ruff around the high neckline of a black velvet jacket that Marie had fashioned for me in France. She also cleaned and pressed my flattering russet gown with its bands of black velvet. It went well with the jacket and provided a jolt of color. Once I was dressed, Françoise pronounced me passable, though too severe and German-looking for her tastes. I bolted down some stew filled with chunks of rabbit and barley at midday in an effort to speed our departure. Matthew took an interminable time sipping his wine and questioning me in Latin about my morning. His expression was devilish.
"If you're trying to infuriate me, you're succeeding," I told him after a particularly convoluted question.
"Refero mihi in latine, quae so,"
Matthew said in a professorial tone. When I threw a hunk of bread at him, he laughed and ducked. Henry Percy arrived just in time to catch the bread neatly with one hand. He returned it to the table without comment, smiled serenely, and asked if we were ready to depart. Pierre materialized without a sound from the shadows near the entrance to the shoe shop and began walking up the street with a diffident air, his right hand firmly around the hilt of his dagger. When Matthew turned us toward the city, I looked up. There was St. Paul's. "I'm not likely to get lost with that in the neighborhood," I murmured. As we made our slow progress toward the cathedral, my senses grew accustomed to the chaos, and it was possible to pick out individual sounds, smells, and sights. Bread baking, coal fires, wood smoke, fermentation, freshly washed garbage courtesy of yesterday's rains, wet wool. I breathed deeply, making a mental note to stop telling my students that if you went back in time, you would be knocked over instantly by the foul smell. Apparently, that wasn't true, at least not in late December. Men and women looked up from their work and out their windows with unabashed curiosity as we passed, bobbing their heads respectfully when they recognized Matthew and Henry. We stepped by a printing establishment, past another where a barber was cutting a man's hair, and skirted a busy workshop where hammers and heat indicated that someone was working in fine metals. As the strangeness wore off, I was able to focus on what people were saying, the texture of their clothes, the expressions on their faces. Matthew had told me our neighborhood was full of foreigners, but it sounded like babble. I turned my head. "What language is she speaking?" I whispered with a glance at a plump woman wearing a deep blue-green jacket trimmed with fur. It was, I noted, cut rather like my own. "Some dialect of German," Matthew said, lowering his head to mine so that I could hear him over the noise in the street. We passed through the arch of an old gatehouse. The lane widened into a street that had managed against all odds to retain most of its paving. A sprawling, multi-storied building to our right buzzed with activity.
"The Dominican Priory," Matthew explained. "When King Henry expelled the priests, it became a ruin, then a tenement. There's no telling how many people are crammed in there now."
He glanced across the courtyard, where a listing stone and timber wall spanned the distance between the tenement and the back of another house. A sorry excuse for a door hung from a single set of hinges. Matthew looked up at St. Paul's and then down at me. His face softened. To hell with caution. Come on.
He steered me through an opening between a section of the old city wall and a house that looked as though it were about to tip its third story onto passers-by. It was possible to make progress along the slim thoroughfare only because everyone was moving in the same direction. Up, north, out. We were carried by the wave of humanity into another street. This one much wider than Water Lane. The noise increased, along with the crowds.
You said the city was deserted because of the holidays, I remarked.
It is, Matthew replied.
After a few steps, we were pitched into an even greater maelstrom. I stopped in my tracks. St. Paul's windows glimmered in the pale afternoon light. The churchyard around it was a solid mass of people. Men, women, children, apprentices, servants, clergymen, soldiers. Those who weren't shouting were listening to those who were, and everywhere you looked there was paper. It was hung up on strings outside bookstalls, nailed to any solid surface, made into books and waved in the faces of onlookers. A group of young men huddled around one post covered with flapping announcements, listening to someone slowly sound out job advertisements. Every now and then, one would break free from the rest, hand slapping him on the back as he pulled his cap down and set off in search of employment.
Oh, Matthew.
It was all I could manage. People continued to swarm around us, carefully avoiding the tips of the long swords my escorts wore at their waists. A breeze caught at my hood. I felt a tingle, followed by a faint pressure. Somewhere in the busy churchyard, a witch and a demon had sensed our presence. Three creatures and a nobleman traveling together were hard to ignore.
We've caught someone's attention, I said.
Matthew didn't seem overly concerned as he scanned the nearby faces.
Someone like me? Someone like Kit? No one like you?
Not yet, he said under his breath. You aren't to come here by yourself, Diana. Ever. Stay in the Blackfriars with Francoise. If you go any farther than that passageway, Matthew nodded behind us, Pierre or I must be with you.
When he was satisfied that I had taken his warning seriously, he drew me away.
Let's go see Mary.
We turned south again, toward the river, and the wind flattened my skirts against my legs. Though we were walking downhill, every step was a struggle. A low whistle sounded as we passed by one of London's many churches, and Pierre disappeared into an alley. He popped out of another just as I spotted a familiar-looking building behind a wall.
That's our house.
Matthew nodded and directed my attention down the street.
And that is Baynard's castle.
It was the largest building I had seen yet, except for the tower, St. Paul's, and the distant prospect of Westminster Abbey. Three crenellated towers faced the river, linked by walls that were easily twice the height of any nearby houses.
Baynard's castle was built to be approached from the river, Diana, Henry said in an apologetic tone as we traveled down another winding lane. This is the back entrance, and not how visitors are supposed to arrive, but it's a great deal warmer on a day like this.
We ducked into an imposing gatehouse. Two men wearing charcoal-gray uniforms with maroon, black, and gold badges strolled up to identify the visitors. One recognized Henry and grabbed at his companion's sleeve before he could question us.
Lord Northumberland. We're here to see the Countess.
Henry swung his cloak in the direction of the guard.
See if you can get that dry, and find Master Royden's man something hot to drink if you would.
The Earl cracked his fingers inside his leather gloves and grimaced.
Of course, my lord,
the gatekeeper said, eyeing Pierre with suspicion. The castle was arranged around two enormous hollow squares, the central spaces filled with leafless trees and the vestiges of summer flowers. We climbed a wide set of stairs and met up with more liveried servants, one of whom led us to the Countess's solar, an inviting room with large, south-facing windows overlooking the river. They provided a view of the same stretch of the Thames that was visible from the Blackfriars. Despite the similarity of the view,
There was no mistaking this lofty, bright space for our house. Though our rooms were large and comfortably furnished, Baynard's castle was the home of aristocracy, and it showed. Wide, cushioned settles flanked the fireplace, along with chairs so deep that a woman could curl up in one with all her skirts tucked around her. Tapestries enlivened the stone walls with splashes of bright color and scenes from classical mythology. There were signs, too, of a scholar's mind at work. Books, bits of ancient statuary, natural objects, pictures, maps, and other curiosities covered the tables.
Master Royden?
A man with a pointed beard and dark hair peppered with gray stood. He held a small board in one hand and a tiny brush in the other.
Hilliard, Matthew said, his delight evident. What brings you here?
A commission from Lady Pembroke, the man said, waving his palette. I must put the finishing touches on this miniature. She wishes to have it for a gift at the new year.
His bright brown eyes studied me.
I forget you have not met my wife. Diana, this is Nicholas Hilliard, the limner.
I am honored, I said, dipping into a curtsy. London had well over 100,000 residents. Why did Matthew have to know everyone that historians would one day find significant?
I know and admire your work. She has seen the portrait of Sir Walter that you painted for me last year, Matthew said smoothly, covering up my too effusive greeting. One of his best pieces, I agree, Henry said, looking over the artist's shoulder. This seems destined to rival it, though. What an excellent likeness of Mary, Hilliard. You've captured the intensity of her gaze.
Hilliard looked pleased. A servant appeared with wine, and Henry, Matthew, and Hilliard conversed in low voices, while I examined an ostrich egg set in gold and a nautilus shell in a silver stand, both of which sat on the table along with several priceless mathematical instruments that I didn't dare touch.
Matt!
The Countess of Pembroke stood in the doorway, wiping ink-stained fingers on a handkerchief hastily supplied by her maid. I wondered why anyone would bother, since her mistress's dove-gray gown was already splotched and even singed in places. The Countess peeled the simple garment from her body, revealing a far more splendid velvet and taffeta outfit in a rich shade of plum. As she passed the early modern equivalent of a lab coat to her servant, I smelled a distinct whiff of gunpowder. The Countess tucked up a tight curl of blonde hair that had drifted down by her right ear. She was tall and willowy, with creamy skin and deep-set brown eyes. She stretched out her hands in welcome.
My dear friend, I've not seen you for years, not since my brother Philip's funeral.
Mary, Matthew said, bowing over her hand, you are looking well.
London does not agree with me, as you know, but it has become a tradition that we travel here for the Queen's anniversary celebrations, and I stayed on. I'm working on Philip's Psalms and a few other fancies, and do not mind it so much. And there are consolations, like seeing old friends.
Mary's voice was airy, but it still conveyed her sharp intelligence.
You are indeed flourishing,
Henry said, adding his welcome to Matthew's and looking at the Countess approvingly. Mary's brown eyes fixed on me.
And who is this?
My happiness at seeing you has pushed my manners aside. Lady Pembroke, this is my wife, Diana. We are recently wed.
My lady.
I dropped the Countess a deep curtsy. Mary's shoes were encrusted with fantastic gold and silver embroidery that suggested Eden, covered as they were with snakes, apples, and insects. They must have cost a fortune.
Mistress Royden, she said, her eyes snapping with amusement. Now that that's over with, let us be plain Mary and Diana. Henry tells me that you are a student of alchemy.
A reader of alchemy, my lady, I corrected. That is all. Lord Northumberland is too generous.
Matthew took my hand in his. And you are too modest. She knows a vast amount, Mary. As Diana is new to London, Hal thought you might help her find her way in the city.
With pleasure, the Countess of Pembroke said. Come, we shall sit by the window. Master Hilliard requires strong light for his work. While he finishes my portrait, you will tell me all the news.
Little happens in the kingdom that's beyond Matthew's notice and understanding, Diana. And I have been at home in Wiltshire for months. Once we were settled, her servant returned with a plate of preserved fruit.
Ooh,
Henry said, happily wiggling his fingers over the yellow, green, and orange confections.
Comfits. You make them like no one else.
And I shall share my secret with Diana, Mary said, looking pleased. Of course, once she has the receipt, I may never have the pleasure of Henry's company again.
Now, Mary, you go too far,
he protested around a mouthful of candied orange peel.
Is your husband with you, Mary? Or does the Queen's business keep him in Wales? Matthew inquired.
The Earl of Pembroke left Milford Haven several days ago, but will go to court rather than come here. I have William and Philip with me for company, and we will not linger much longer in the city but go on to Ramsbury. The air is healthier there. A sad look crossed her face. Mary's words reminded me of the statue of William Herbert in the Bodleian Library quadrangle. The man I passed on the way to Duke Humphrey's every day, and one of the library's greatest benefactors, was this woman's young son. "How old are your children?" I asked, hoping that the question was not too personal. The Countess's face softened. "William is 10, and Philip is just 6. My daughter Anne is 7, but she was ill this past month, and my husband felt she should remain at Wilton."
"Nothing serious," Matthew frowned.
More shadows scudded across the Countess's face. "Any sickness that affects my children is serious," she said softly.
"Forgive me, Mary. I spoke without thinking. My intention was only to offer what assistance I can."
My husband's voice deepened with regret. The conversation was touching on a shared history unknown to me. "You have kept those I love from harm on more than one occasion. I haven't forgotten it, Matthew. Nor would I fail to call on you again if necessary. But Anne suffered from a child's ague, nothing more. The physicians assured me she will recover." Mary turned to me. "Do you have children, Diana?" "Not yet," I said, shaking my head. Matthew's gray glance settled on me for a moment, then flitted away. I tugged nervously at the bottom of my jacket.
"Diana has not been married before," Matthew said.
"Never?" The Countess of Pembroke was fascinated by this piece of information and opened her mouth to question me further. Matthew cut her off.
"Her father and mother died when she was young. There was no one to arrange it."
Mary's sympathy increased. "A young girl's life is sadly dependent upon the whims of her guardians."
"Indeed."
Matthew arched an eyebrow at me. I could imagine what he was thinking. I was lamentably independent, and Sarah and Em were the least whimsical creatures on earth. The conversation moved on to politics and current events. I listened attentively for a while, trying to reconcile hazy recollections of long-ago history class with the complicated gossip that the other three exchanged. There was talk of war, a possible Spanish invasion, Catholic sympathizers, and the religious tension in France, but the names and places were often unfamiliar. As I relaxed into the warmth of Mary's solar, and comforted by the constant chatter, my mind drifted.
"I am done here, Lady Pembroke. My servant Isaac will deliver the miniature by week's end,"
Hilliard announced, packing up his equipment.
"Thank you, Master Hilliard."
The Countess extended her hand, sparkling with jewels from her many rings. He kissed it, nodded to Henry and Matthew, and departed. "Such a talented man," Mary said, shifting in her chair. "He's grown so popular I was fortunate to secure his services." Her feet twinkled in the firelight, the silver embroidery on her richly colored slippers picking up hints of red, orange, and gold. I wondered idly who had designed the intricate pattern for the embroidery. Had I been closer, I would have asked to touch the stitches. Jean-Pierre had been able to read my flesh with his fingers. Could an inanimate object provide similar information? Though my fingers were nowhere near the Countess's shoes, I saw the face of a young woman. She was peering at a sheet of paper with the design for Mary's shoes on it. Tiny holes along the lines of the drawing solved the mystery of how its intricacies had been transferred to leather. Focusing on the drawing, my mind's eye took several steps backward in time. Now I saw Mary sitting with a stern